Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the podcast, our roundtable. But first, Joe Biden may be president-elect, but President Trump is refusing to concede the election as of this Friday and has refused to start the formal transition process that includes starting intelligence briefings for the incoming team, as well as office space and other support. The president-elect has named his teams to oversee the transition with Dr. Kath Hicks of the Center for Strategic and International Studies leading the 23-member team over at the Department of Defense that includes former Pentagon Comptroller Mike McCord, Andrew Hunter, and many more. Also complicating the transition was the president's decision to fire Mark Esper as defense secretary and install Chris Miller as the acting defense secretary, a move that precipitated other resignations. Joining us today are two men who have been intimately involved in the defense side of the presidential transition for the past four decades. Michael Baer, the chairman of the Defense Business Board and the president of the Dumbarton Strategies Consultancy, and Arnold Panaro, a former staff director of the Senate Armed Services Committee, who is now the chairman of the Panaro Group Consultancy, as well as the chairman of the National Defense Industrial Association. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning, Bago.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy, and Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Bell, Beretta USA, and Leonardo DRS all sponsored our coverage of AUSA Now, the Association of the United States Army's annual meeting this year conducted virtually. Gentlemen, as I said, thanks very much. It's a pleasure always having you on. Certainly an interesting transition. I think each one is unique in their way. This one is, I think, a little bit more unique in that, you know, the president has yet to concede. There's a lot of pressure increasing on him. Obviously, Chris Krebs of CISA, the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, saying this election was the most secure in American history. That coming from the senior most person when it comes to cyber infrastructure protection in the U.S. government. You've always both made the case that time is the most important commodity, whether it's in a transition or making decisions in government. Does it matter, Michael, that the transition hasn't started yet?
Well, Vago, let me lay a little bit of a foundation first, and that is that underneath the change of presidents is another genius of this democracy, which is a periodic fresh look by the winners of how the machinery of government actually works. And then they put fresh hands at work to doing those tasks. So a transition is really a reinvention of government and essential for a democracy like ours. And these 4 or 8 year transitions are each individually a challenge and an opportunity for the president and his team. But this is perhaps the most challenging transition, and that is a change of the party in control. In the last 50 years, there have only been 4, Ford Carter, Carter Reagan, Bush Obama, and Obama Trump. And in 2012, Secretary Gates wasn't changed out. So also there hasn't been a change of administration in the midst of a global peer struggle for more than 40 years. Also unique to this, Joe Biden is the first Democrat to be elected without his party in control of the Senate since Grover Cleveland in 1884. Now, Arnold knows better than anyone the consequences of how you get your team together when you don't control the United States Senate. Arnold, thoughts?
That's a very important observation. And I think that's going to be one of the key priorities of the Biden transition team, particularly the team that's been identified to work with the Department of Defense. 23 members led by Kath Hicks, a very experienced, very knowledgeable expert on the department. And they're going to have to understand that this is the largest, most complex organization in the world. It's got operational responsibilities worldwide. It's really important that you get experienced, qualified people in these key jobs. Each of the budgets of the military departments, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, are larger separately than every other cabinet department in government, except for the Veterans Administration. So getting your people through the Senate Armed Services Committee confirmation process, which I ran for 15 years as the staff director, and you and I have been involved with every administration helping them with their nominees since 1997, that's a very important consideration. You know, you've got to have people that match up with the experience and qualifications against these extremely demanding jobs in the Pentagon if they have any hopes of getting through a Armed Services Committee in Senate that's controlled by the other party.
Let me ask, though, whether or not this delay impacts it, right? We understand that Kath Hicks is very, very experienced and somebody suited for, you know, any senior job in the department. Mike McCord is part of that team as well, former Pentagon comptroller and highly respected. You know, both Andy Card and John Podesta, Andy Card, of course, George W. Bush's chief of staff, and then John Podesta, Bill Clinton's chief of staff, both said the same thing, that there's a national security danger by delaying the transition. What are the implications of delaying it by a week or 2 weeks until the president comes to grips with the fact that he did, in fact, lose the election and Joe Biden is going to be the next president?
Well, Vago, my experience, and I think as Arnold's over the last 30 years of working with these transition teams, is that there is a lot that occurs during those 70 plus days from the election until the inauguration. But much of it occurs independent of the materials or the insights they get from the outgoing administration. My experience, which is 80, 88, 2000, 2008, and 2016, is the materials we received from the outgoing administration were not terribly helpful at the departmental transition level. For the president to get the national intelligence, the daily brief, those are important. The Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State, the same. But at the mechanical level, at the deputy secretary below, the materials that are derived are oftentimes the products of staff input and are not all that terribly useful. The challenge for the administration is to organize their own decisions they've made previously as policy with the people selections they have made, and then converting those people selections and policy into implementable plans. That's the key to actually having success. And that the time for to close in with the administration, have the landing teams actually walking the halls of the Pentagon, that's useful symbolically. But in my experience, I've not seen a lot of value derived for the incoming team from that experience.
I would separate it into two parts, Vago, sort of like Michael did. I would say it really is important for President-elect Biden, Vice President-elect Harris, his key staffers, to begin to receive the kind of intelligence about what's going on in the world, the flashpoints at the highly classified level, so they can begin to understand the framework they're going to be inheriting there. That should start right away. And even Republican members of the Senate have been pushing for that. The second thing is they should allow the FBI to start clearing the 100 plus people that are eligible under the Transition Act so that there won't be any delays once he's sworn in, getting his top cabinet and top national security people confirmed. So those are the two things where you're concerned about the delays. But Michael's right. In terms of the transition team itself, I guarantee you that Kath Hicks, because of her strong leadership, she's not losing any ground in terms of getting ready on the four key elements you have to get ready on for transition. One, you're looking at policy issues. Two, you're looking at personnel. Three, you're looking at programs, ships, tanks, airplanes. And four, you're looking at the organization of the Department of Defense. They can do a lot of that without being actually in the physical spaces of the Pentagon. So my view is that what ought to be accelerated and is allowing them to get up to speed on the intelligence side and allowing them to get their people cleared. We don't want to take 11 months like the Trump administration did, getting their top national security people confirmed. We'd like to see it, you know, 4 months or under, like it happened at the beginning of the Obama administration. So those are the things that need to be happening, but I don't see the official transition team at this point, as Michael said, losing any ground. Now, if it drags out for another month, that might be a different situation.
Let me take you guys to the question of change in leadership. We talked about why that would be bad. There was a hope last week that would not be the case, that Dr. Esper would be in position to ensure, and his team, to ensure a smooth transition. Obviously, having somebody like Dave Norquist as the deputy, somebody who has been intimately, you know, has been in there since the start of the administration and serving nobly. Walk us through what the implications are of such a dramatic change at the very top, which I don't know really has ever happened before, where the Secretary of Defense is relieved, you know, some 60, 70 days before the inauguration. What are the implications and challenges? Michael, start us off, and then Arnold, finish us off.
Well, Vago, first of all, in my experience, and I believe in Arnold's, the epicenter for transition at the department is really the deputy secretary. The secretary sets the tone, sets the environment in which it operates. But mechanically, you know, with the incoming landing teams and the transition team, which sets up and operates through May, June, and makes sure all the people and mechanical pieces are done, their interactions are most principally done through the deputies. And traditionally, those deputies, actually the outgoing deputy, stays for much of that transition period. Rudy De Leon, who was an extraordinary deputy secretary in the Clinton administration, stayed well into the summer as a shadowing the confirmed deputy secretary, Paul Wolfowitz. And that tradition has stayed going forward, that deputy secretary remains is the hub and spoke around all of which happens. And David Norquist, who I think is well regarded by this transition team, landing team, and is well known to them and knows them, I think is the beginnings of what should be a civil handoff when the president allows it to occur. But as Arnold said, that's going to be up to the White House. But Arnold's experience is very profound in this.
Yeah, I agree with Michael. I think the Biden team would be well advised to keep David Norquist on until their own deputy is confirmed, and even some after that, as was the case with Rudy and Bob Work. Number two, I don't think the change at the top when it comes to transition, the three or four new people they have, including the active Secretary of Defense, and these may be super individuals in their own right, they're going to be of hardly any value to the transition at all, because they aren't going to know anything about what's going on in the Department of Defense. And they won't have the details of the budget. Their policy positions in many cases are going to be anathema to the Biden team. So that isn't going to have an impact on the transition. And the president himself, there are a lot of things he can do without the Congress. He can bring troops home without the Congress. He can redeploy troops without the Congress. So the people at the top of the Pentagon, while, you know, you typically wouldn't want to see that kind of turbulence this close to a transition to a new administration, I don't consider that to be that detrimental to the transition. Over.
And Vago, if I could, just one more really critical point. If it, in a perverse way, the fact that key individuals in this administration have been relieved and are now back at home ease the access of the transition team to them. They don't have to fight through a cluttered Secretary of Defense's schedule to reach Mark Esper. He's available on the other end of the phone. One phone call will access him. So too any of the other previously departed administration officials. So in an odd way, the president's relief of these people has eased the transition team's access to them. Over.
Let me ask one last question, though. If the president, very briefly, Arnold, if the president tells Chris Miller, you're to make things difficult for them, how does Dave Norquist successfully cooperate with Kath Hicks to make this go off smoothly?
Well, there are laws that apply here, Vago, and so the Department of Defense obeys legal orders. And so I think the Department of Defense would look at the law and they would operate consistent with the law. And at some point, the statute governing transition is going to kick in. And, you know, again, these are extremely experienced individuals. Both the Biden senior team, we've worked, these people were in the Senate when we were there for 24 years. They know their way around Washington. They're going to be able to overcome any hurdles or roadblocks. The president, if he continues on the kind of sore loser streak, as the media has called it, they're going to figure ways to get around that. So I'm not that concerned about that.
And one last thing, Arnold, because you did spend so much time in the Senate, there are progressives who are pushing back against possible nominees on the Biden side, Michelle Flournoy being one of them, who's regarded widely as the front runner to become the nation's next defense secretary and first female defense secretary. In part because she has advised industry, and there's this sense that she can somehow not be objective at the end of the day, which I think many people would question. I mean, what did they expect her to do? Go and work at Tom McCann Shoes? At the end of the day, is that going to be something that affects the choice of the nation's next defense secretary? What's the right way to look at that?
Well, I hope it would not be, and I don't think it will be. And if that's their view of Michelle Flournoy, that tells me they don't know anything about her. That's not who she is. She's eminently well qualified for the nearly impossible job of Secretary of Defense. And number two, this is the largest, most complex organization in the world with operational requirements to protect our nation at home and abroad. And you need people with experience, and you also basically have to have the technology that industry brings to bear, so our troops would never be in a fair fight. So the Senate Armed Services Committee is not going to have the standard that these progressives have outlined during the Senate confirmation process for the Department of Defense.
Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us. Really, really appreciate it. Always a pleasure. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Vago.
Thank you, Vago. Thank you, Vago.
Joining us to discuss the week in Washington are Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners, Dr. Gordon Adams of the Quincy Institute think tank, Michael Herson of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense lobbying firms, Christopher Preble of the Atlantic Council, and former Pentagon comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who among his many other hats is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Everybody, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Thank you, Vago.
Be here, Vago.
Thank you, Vago. Good to be back.
All right, Michael, start us off. 224,000 dead with new daily infections of more than 150,000. So it looks like the nation is going into a very grim period. We're up on the Hill where the National Defense Authorization Act is making progress. Senate Defense Appropriations marks are done. And we also have conversations about yet another stimulus package as the parties are devolving into a sense of internecine warfare, whether over the president's decision to not concede or progressives and centrists kind of duking it out in the Democratic Party for influence in a new centrist Biden administration. Walk us through where we are on the Hill. And we're also going to get to the issue of Dr. Esper's firing in a little bit. But let's just start off where we are on some of the financials here. And the political mood.
Okay, sure. So I'll start with where we are with some of the legislative actions that need to be taken care of in the lame duck session since Congress is coming back in next week. NDAA conference continues to proceed. The Big Four had a second meeting on Monday and are scheduled, actually on Tuesday, and are scheduled to have a third meeting next Monday. So progress is getting made at NDAA, and people feel confident that that bill will get to the floor, during the lame duck session. There are some sticking points that we've talked about in the past, especially when it comes to renaming the bases named after Confederate generals. But there are some creative solutions being worked out to try and get that bill passed and avoid a presidential veto, and while still being able to rename the bases in the future. Then on appropriations, as you mentioned, the Senate posted their defense appropriations markup along with the other Senate appropriations subcommittees. However, there's no time to consider these bills individually on the floor. So these bills will go straight to conference, which prevents anybody in the Senate from amending or changing anything that was in the Senate bill. So there's still optimism that an omnibus or some kind of minibus will be passed in the lame duck session and possibly with some coronavirus relief attached to it. There's still a deadlock over a relief package. Pelosi and Schumer both now are calling for passage of the HEROES Act, which is the original one with the price tag of $3 trillion. While McConnell is reiterating his preference for the smaller package of $500 billion. Pelosi said in a press conference of the day, we're in the same place that we were before. After the election, both sides are feeling emboldened. Pelosi and Schumer feel that Biden's win is a referendum on Trump's handling of the coronavirus, while Republicans on the Hill think the Democrats' poor performance in the congressional races means that the GOP now has more leverage in the fight over relief package. So we're still nowhere on that. I think if something does pass, which this year, I think it'll be something much smaller with the hope that something bigger will pass in the next administration. You know, I think Democrats rightfully are alleging the GOP refusal to accept the results are imperiling the U.S. coronavirus response. As cases continue to spike and deaths continue to spike.
It really is extraordinary. If you look at the trajectory we're on, is potentially very, very dangerous. Are folks talking much about what happened to Mark Esper? Obviously, the president, everybody in an administration serves at the president's pleasure. He fired Dr. Esper. Chris Miller is the acting secretary. We've been talking about Mark Esper, unfortunately, likely to get relieved. There are many others that are expected to follow, including, unfortunately, Chris Krebs, the extraordinary CISA director at Homeland Security, for the press conference he gave just yesterday, saying the American elections were the most secure ever. Are lawmakers up there talking about this? Because there is this perception that some of these changes in the Pentagon are being made so that the president can withdraw all American forces from the Middle East, sort of making good on a campaign promise, and that increasing worries in the Pentagon of a precipitous departure, for example, from Afghanistan.
So I've been talking to leaders in both parties, and actually I actually emailed with Mark earlier this morning. But you know, look, it's something that's actually not getting as much attention because I think that people, you know, knew that Mark would be leaving at the end of this administration, win or lose. I think a lot of people were concerned about what the president's behavior would be between November 3rd and January 20th, and that's all playing out. I think the immediate concern among the Democrats on the Hill is, you know, the fact that Emily Murphy, the head of the GSA, has not certified the election, you know, and her refusal to do so prevents Biden's transition team from coordinating the transfer of power with federal agencies. So, you know, on the Hill right now, they're looking at several options. One, you know, to call her in to testify, perhaps the Democrats in Congress suing her directly, or having the Biden campaign sue her directly to force her to cooperate. But meantime, you know, the Democrats' majority continues to shrink by the day. More and more races are getting called in favor of Republicans. It's possible the Democrats' majority is as small as half a dozen seats. So tensions inside the Democratic Party continue to boil over. For example, Hakeem Jeffries, who's the conference chair, caucus chair, said the other day that, you know, do we want to govern or do we want to be internet celebrities, which forced, you know, Ocasio-Cortez to tweet right back at him that it's pretty astounding that some Democrats don't believe it's possible to govern, be politically popular, and command formidable bully pulpits at the same time, you know, so that we can do both and win. And it looks like her squad of four is looking to gain three people. So the squad next year could be seven members. And there's a lot of fear whether this group of progressives becomes like the Freedom Caucus of the right and really, you know, cause a lot of gridlock and slows things down. At the same time, you know, the president's refusal to accept the election results is, you know, resulting in some really crazy stuff out there, even on the congressional level. I mean, the guy who ran against Karen Bass in California got 13.6% of the vote. He's refusing to concede because he's alleging election fraud. So, you know, since we spoke last, a lot more states have been called, but there's still votes to be counted in Georgia and North Carolina. But it's really becoming clear to everybody, even obviously it's already clear to Democrats, but more and more Republicans are starting to realize that, you know, it's time to cooperate with the transition and cooperate with the transition of power. But I believe that some of these folks will just sit back and continue to take their cue from the president, which really creates a lot of uncertainty as to whether the president will cooperate with NDAA, will he cooperate with appropriations, will he cooperate with a relief package. So a lot of uncertainty tied to the president and Capitol Hill.
And obviously, I think Ocasio-Cortez has a point. You can win, but in certain places, right? You can win in progressive districts, as we've seen. That message certainly didn't work in some swing districts that Democrats got in 18, but then lost this year. Byron, you've been looking very closely at the appropriations and the mark. Give us sort of your sense on all of this, and especially where we are legislatively.
Well, look, I agree.
Or programmatically, I might add.
Yeah, I agree with Michael on the timing of this. I mean, not too surprisingly, the Senate added, I think it was additional F-35s, you know, the long lead for the second Virginia class submarine. It is interesting, though, that they cut RDT&E That's kind of in line with the House. Some of this was early to need, but I think, you know, some of the larger cuts, there was a $1 billion cut to classified programs in the Air Force. That was kind of intriguing. Obviously, we don't know the reason for that. And then the other thing that kind of stuck out was the cut that was made to the large unmanned surface combatant program that the Navy's pursuing. And, you know, some of the chatter was, look, is this more kind of a Luddite reaction to some of the changes the Department of Defense is pursuing by the Senate and frankly by the House as well too. I don't know. I mean, I can see some of the risk issues that need to be ironed out here, but I don't think that there's anything that looks like it's glaringly a roadblock that won't let something get done here. And I think the market, frankly, the defense companies, contractors are probably indifferent. You know, if this gets done in December, that's good. If it slips in another CR into the, you know, January, February timeframe, you know, if you look at the earnings reports, where these guys are financially, you know, just kind of how they've been acclimated to living with CRs for a while. I think that's fine as far as the public companies are concerned.
Chris, this is the first time you're joining us for one of these roundtables, so welcome aboard.
Thanks.
Terrific Atlantic Council event, by the way, regarding the role of the United States in the world, you know, as we struggle with coronavirus, but also work with a new administration. Give us sort of your sense on all of this that's going on, and, you know, how. Right. I mean, there's also this big debate, and just to cue both of you, both Gordon and Dove up, you know, I do want to get into a little bit of transition issues as well, and progressives' pressure on the Biden administration to be very restrictive in terms of lobbyists or people who have defense connections. Obviously, you know, that's seen as valuable experience to going into key Pentagon jobs, whereas progressives are looking at this as you're beholden to external interests. But sort of give us your sense on where we are and where we're going politically, budgetarily, and potentially strategically.
Well, I mean, I think the one thing that I'm most sort of comfortable talking about is how the Biden administration deals with coronavirus and to what extent that sends a message to the rest of the world that the United States is actually capable of solving its own problems and therefore might someday again be trusted to try to help others solve their problems. I think that this is only the latest example of why the rest of the world is, I think, reasonably skeptical that the United States is and should be the only leader capable of doing these things. And this is something that I've been writing about for a long time, but I think, you know, to me, one of the more perversely encouraging signs of the spring and summer, and I want to come back to this, is that some of America's allies who in an earlier era would have been utterly incapable of dealing with something like the coronavirus really led the way. You know, certainly formal allies like South Korea or New Zealand, but even Taiwan, which, you know, sort of falls in a different category. But, you know, these are countries that were once, you know, ROK was one of the poorest countries in the world when the Korean War started. And here you have them really setting the standard for the rest of the world. Now, the interesting case is in Europe is that the Europeans, of course, instituted very, very stark restrictions. And now they're suffering from a second wave. So the story is that the virus gets a vote, so to speak. This is a really hard thing to deal with. One last point. You know, this is going to be solved. It's a global pandemic, and it's going to be solved through global cooperation. And when we sort of look past the amount of information sharing that's gone on among clinicians and physicians and researchers and on a vaccine and all those sorts of things. And I think that really is a model for the future, is the United States is going to be engaged with the rest of the world, but is not going to be able to call the shots and expect the rest of the world to just dance.
Gordon, Dove, your sense on any of the parts of what's happened over the past week, including what Chris said, which I think there's an enormous amount of merit to that, right? I mean, in a sense, it's good that everybody did stand up and do it. On the other hand, you can also sense the vacuum globally because the indispensable power has not only not brought its allies and partners together, but actively competed against them and continued to prosecute trade wars and a whole bunch of other things, right? I mean, Chris, there was the layoffs of the 9,000, South Korean employees that are critical to supporting our troops in the country, or half of them were laid off.
Bago, don't get me wrong. I mean, when the purported leader of the free world does not act like a leader of the free world, that is not good for anyone and not good for us. And I think we've certainly seen examples of that under the Trump administration. What I'm saying is that there are workable alternatives to a vacuum or the United States doing everything. And I think we're actually seeing those workable alternatives play out right before us.
Gordon?
Yeah, a lot of material here. Just some points that I think maybe we're throwing onto the pile. On the transition, governmental transition that we're talking about here, the contestation of the election and so on, we've seen sort of declaration of victory and business as usual and nothing to see here, morphing in media terms into a lot of contestation, a lot of struggles, lawyers all over the place, into an argument now about whether state legislatures are going to get involved in the process and certify electors that don't reflect the vote that happened in the state because the vote was supposedly fraudulent. So we've still got some battles over the next month, I think, that are going to be fought here, although my general sense is things are trending towards an acceptance of the reality by perhaps everybody except the president and the people immediately around him, notably his sons. There is still noticeable reluctance to accept this in the Republican Party. And I think that's a challenge that the Republicans now have. As of yesterday, I think Romney, Collins, Murkowski, Sass had all congratulated Biden, but that the line stopped there. But there is this second wave of movement of people saying, for transition purposes, this guy should really be getting the president's daily brief. There should be an intelligence communication, whatever the outcome of this contestation of the election. And I see that as a sign of things starting to move in a direction of saying there's an inevitability here. But we've got, I think, two or three, maybe right up to the 14th of December when the Electoral College is supposed to certify this. The head of the agency that is responsible for ascertaining that this is the nominee and therefore unleashing office space and transition money and access is actually an ascertainment, not a certification. Certification happens by the states and then is certified in another stage by the Electoral College. But I think between then and now, we're going to have a lot of choppy water that's going to get in the way of other things that need attention and cooperation, like bills and will the president sign and what's his attitude going to be. And a lot of this is going to be driven, of course, by the eccentricity of Donald Trump. Coming to the question of the transition, which you had raised, transitions always take a slightly different character, administration to administration, but there are, GSA ascertains that there is a winner here that's been declared mostly by the media, not legally, and opens doors to cooperation on information and office space and some funding for the transition. That's all very important. A lot of this can be done informally. A lot of this is people who know each other and so the people who are coming in on the defense team and the State Department team and so on, they're old hands. They kind of know the ropes. They know the location. I think one of the things to focus on here, though, in this particular transition is the budgetary issue. And this comes back to the question of defense top line. And I've said this before, in a transition, since Clinton, because before that, the outgoing administration submitted a budget in early January because they were statutorily required to. It's now early February. So when you change from one party to the other, the outgoing administration often doesn't submit a budget at all. We didn't have a budget from when I was at the Clinton administration. Nothing was there except a current services book from the outgoing George H.W. Bush administration. In this administration's case, there clearly has been a lot of budget work done. Esper oversaw a whole budget process. It's been churning away. And as you say, the president announced that he wanted all the agencies and Russ Vought at OMB to proceed as if a budget was going to be submitted, because, of course, I'm the president. I'll be here after January 20th. And so there will be something floating somewhere. But I will tell you, because of my experience both in Clinton and in the transition for Obama, in which I also served, that in the White House Obama OMB transition group, we never had any formal documentation of any kind from the Defense Department. Right. There never was a budget submit that came from Bob Gates. He sat on the chiefs who wanted plus $50 billion at that point. And he was transitioning to be Secretary of Defense in the new administration. And the same thing happened in the previous administration, in the Clinton administration. There was a current services document. That means, as I've said before, that the budget, the first budget that a Biden administration submits is going to be done fast in the White House and largely at the top line level. People don't really appreciate that. We have this sense that there's this thing churning away and all these max accounts get filled and blah, blah, blah. This is not, this year is different from all other years because of that reality. It is likely to be accentuated by the reluctance of the administration and Emily Murphy at GSA to ascertain that Biden is the incoming president, because that is holding off formal communication of information between the incoming team and the outgoing team. Now, what that means is, I think this is a thing for us to keep our eye on this ball for a couple of months at least, is that this planning will be done largely at the top line level, and it will be done largely at OMB and in the White House. That has real implications for top line level, not so much for program, but for top line level on the defense budget, because the White House does trade-offs like the Pentagon doesn't do them when they prepare a budget. And I've seen this in two transitions, and it happened both times. So it leaves a question mark. I don't expect a major cut in the defense budget, but I do expect it to be heavily influenced by presidential commitments, by the COVID package, by the infrastructure package, and other things that the Biden administration is committed to. So that's a piece I'm keeping my eye on.
Dove, you too have gone through a couple of transitions, given that you've served in the Pentagon several times, last time as Pentagon comptroller. You know, give us your sense on all of this, you know, budgetary, political, right? I mean, this is kind of a very mixed and open bag that we're trying to tackle this week.
Absolutely. And I was on the receiving end of Gordon Adams's non-budget in 2000, and I'll get to that, in 2001, rather. First of all, on the transition itself, you know, when we were transitioning in 2000, I mean, Rumsfeld wasn't even named until December. We waited 30 days. And I think what's been set up to now is correct. There are other ways for people as sophisticated and as experienced as Kath Hicks or Mike McCord or Andrew Hunter and many of the others, they'll get what they need. And of course, they can always go to Mark Esper unofficially now and hear what he has to say. That isn't the biggest worry. In addition, I think people need to understand that there are actually going to be two transition teams, probably for the Pentagon. There usually are. One is the formal one that the White House blesses, and that's normally for people at the deputy assistant secretary, maybe at the assistant secretary level and below. When you get to the unders, that's pretty much the Secretary of Defense's prerogative, and very often for the service secretaries. When it gets to the deputy secretary, it can get tricky. Weinberger had to face off the Reaganauts in 1981 because he wanted Frank Carlucci, and they didn't. He won. Aspen fought the Clinton crowd in the beginning of their administration in 93, and he lost. When you get back to Rumsfeld, Rumsfeld was able to choose whom he wanted. I know that because I went over the different deputy candidates with him before any of them was chosen. So I know that he won on that one. So that's going to vary, and it's going to depend on who the secretary is. And that brings me to a comment made earlier about the progressives not wanting anybody connected with defense industry. Frankly, that's a shot being fired at Michelle Flournoy. She's got those connections. And what they the progressives essentially are saying is, if you don't come from a think tank, presumably a progressive think tank, or directly from the Hill, presumably from a progressive legislator staff or a progressive legislator, or academia, where they all seem to be progressives these days, then we're not going to let you go through. And that becomes leverage if indeed the majority of the Democratic majority goes down to about six, and there are seven of them. Boy, that becomes a real vehicle for pressure by the AOC crowd. Something to bear in mind. In terms of the turnover over there, it, of course, it's not just Mark Esper. It's a few others. And whereas whatever you might say about Chris Miller, at least he's been around. So has his advisor now, Doug McGregor. You may not like their politics, but they've been around. They know how things move. Then that doesn't mean they're going to buck the president. And it's pretty clear they're going to try to push to get out of Afghanistan. But nevertheless, there are others who are being named who don't know their way around, and they're being named to serious jobs. That's a problem. And even on Afghanistan, I'm not sure the president will get what he wants. The military, as we all know, is very, very good at stalling. Give us the formal order. We have to study the order. We have to figure out the logistics. I mean, it can go on and on. The president wants out of Afghanistan, I believe, primarily because he's thinking not so much about his 2016 campaign promise, but about being able to say in 2024, I kept my 2016 promise. But I'm not sure it's going to happen because, as I say, the military is very good at saying, sir. But as you all know, sir doesn't always mean yes, sir. It also means you idiot. On that score, I'm not as pessimistic. And finally, on the budget, Gordon will remember this, or maybe not because he had left by then. But I had to deal with a budget amendment because, and first I had a fight with OMB itself, not Gordon's OMB, but our OMB, because it turned out that Bill Cohen, the outgoing secretary, had actually left a kind of budget with a number. And we wanted a higher number. OMB wanted the lower number, the Cohen number, or even below that. And so that became a major tussle, and Rumsfeld had to go to the president and get that cleared up, and he won the day. We then came in with a budget amendment that didn't just deal with the top line, but also dealt with some elements below that. And that amendment didn't, by the way, get through until the summer. And thank heaven it went through before 9/11 happened. So I suspect the Biden team will not simply take the OMB number and run with it and maybe make a few minor cuts. But you may well see a significant budget amendment again. Depending on the power of the progressives, that it's not going to bring them to a 10% cut, but it could influence how deep the cut might be.
Gordon, I know you want to say something brief, but then want to go and bring Chris and Byron into this as well, as unfortunately Michael had to leave. Go ahead.
Yeah, just two very brief quick points. Point number one, on the transition 2000, thank God I wasn't there, but it's illustrative of the fact that there is a very White House-centric process at the beginning of every administration, and it's likely to be continued in this administration as well, and there will be a tussle over the number. I absolutely predict it. Second point is, I think it's a bit excessive to blame progressives with respect to ethics issues in the White House. Every administration, including the one in which I served and the one in which I served in the transition, has a discussion about what the ethics are going to be, what the rules are going to be that apply to people who are going to have government jobs. And as to be expected, there are going to be people who say you got to stuff the building with people who know the industry. And there are places where I think that's absolutely right and places where I think it bears no relationship at all. And there are people on the progressive side or on the very conservative side who will have another set of agendas. But every transition team has a struggle over what the ethical rules are going to be for political appointees. It's not new or unusual just because there happened to be progressive, a small progressive caucus in the Democratic Party.
But the cry tends to be loudest, and having covered that in 2008, it was very, very loud. Don't have lobbyists in there, and actually went to and if I recall correctly, Bill Lynn was the only person who got exempted from that rule to become Deputy Defense Secretary, where he went on to serve with distinction. I think the issue that many people don't recognize is the vetting, the separation. And if you go and you look at history, anytime somebody who may have had a corporate background, it tends not to benefit at all the company that they came from. In fact, there's always a tendency of those officials to try to recuse themselves or separate themselves. And people also have ultimately gone to jail for having transgressed, right? I mean, you have to trust people and make sure that they're bringing that breadth of experience for the right jobs. Chris, let me bring you into this in terms of how folks should be thinking about this at the end of the day to make sure that you're filling these jobs with the very best talent. At the end of the day, if you look at this, almost everybody recognizes that in this great power competition with China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran, the United States has a small window Right. When I talked to General McConville, the chief of staff of the United States Army, he sort of gave it like 2 years for us to really deliver those kind of deterrent messages and fielding kind of key capabilities. There are many on the Biden team who understand that sense of urgency. How should people be thinking about filling these jobs? And Byron, want to get your sense on this as well as somebody who's observed this. Both in terms of folks who've gone into government, but folks who've also been in industry. Go ahead, Chris.
Well, just two quick points. First of all, I don't think anyone should have been surprised that that President Trump was going to resist fiercely this transition and do whatever he could to slow it down or complicate it. And I think the Biden team, Byron and I were talking offline. I mean, the Biden team knew this. So that's point number one. Point number two is there's an irony that Joe Biden is going to be the oldest president when he's elected. And yet I think there is an opportunity for his administration to be populated by some new voices and new faces, fresh faces, folks who have not necessarily been in government for a long period of time. And I'm encouraged by that, because I think that the lessons that folks younger than me have learned over the last 25 years or so are going to lead in a direction that is likely to be more effective in terms of the United States' engagement to the world, and equally important, could actually win the support of the American people and sustain the support of the American people. So I'm paying very close attention to the names being mentioned for these various transition teams. You know, many of them are familiar to us, but I'm also intrigued by those who have not had a bite at the apple before and really giving them a chance to make their mark and see a new generation sort of rise to the occasion.
Right. And at the end of the day, right, I mean, it's people abiding by both the standards and the rules of ethical behavior at the end of the day that we expected. And I think that, you know, as long as people are abiding by that, you trust them. If they're violating it, you punish them and should send them to jail. Byron, give us your sense as well here.
Look, I think, you know, just kind of stitching together a couple of different things that have been said. Yes, I do think the composition of the transition team is interesting. You know, clearly a lot of known names from some of the major DC think tanks, starting with Kath Hicks, Andrew Hunter, you know, working down the list. I think, you know, if you look at the broader list and including defense, I think there's someone from Rebellion on it. It's just interesting. There's one person from Huntington Ingalls, I believe, on National Security Council, but there's really nothing. No one from any of the major defense contractors, or frankly, some of the minor ones. But there's a good sprinkling of people who come from Silicon Valley backgrounds. And so I think that's one pointer that you could look for in this next 2 years is, you know, is this new administration really going to try and double down on this attempt to lower barriers to entry and try and think about national security more holistically and not just through a fairly narrow lens of the heritage defense contractors? That's one point. And then I think the other point is just kind of the time factor here, which is, and it may be going back to Michael's kind of initial framing on the outcome of the election and who really thought they came ahead. You know, we're, I think it's what, 600, 700 some odd days between the inauguration and the midterm election. And, you know, we're now going to swiftly transition from this election to the midterm election and the jockeying that's going to go on for that. The Republican gains in some of the state races give them the power to redistrict, and that will matter. You know, they could pick up another two seats in Texas alone just from redistricting, so gerrymandering. So it could really be an interesting dynamic here in the next 2 years, not just whether or not there's a second Biden term. And I kind of agree. I think his age is going to limit that. But, you know, what's going to be the outcome of this midterm election and how that will affect behavior in the next year and a half. And I'm not terribly optimistic on that, because I think both sides are going to be gunning very hard for advantage in that time frame. And if the Republicans think they can get an advantage here in the midterm, I don't think a whole lot's going to get done. And this kind of gets back to something you discussed before, which is whether or not gridlock is positive for for the Department of Defense, I tend to think it's not positive. And that maybe to some of Chris's points, that's also going to reverberate through how the rest of the world looks at what the U.S. is capable of doing in the next 2 to 3 years and beyond.
And I just want to point out, Victor Garcia is who you were thinking of, Byron, who is from Rebellion Defense and on the landing team.
Vago, could I just make one point?
Yes, very briefly. I think both you and Gordon have brief points, but very quickly, please. Go on.
Yeah, I think there's a fundamental difference between not wanting lobbyists to get these senior jobs, which there's a good argument for that, and not wanting anybody who had anything to do with defense industry in any way not getting a job. And that seems to be the message that's coming out of the progressives, and that's very, very different. And then you wind up with a situation where if they got their wish, there wouldn't be anybody who understands defense industry at all.
Gordon, go on. And I think that this is in part because Michel Flournoy, obviously the person who is leading in the minds of many to become the nation's next defense secretary, has been a strategic advisor. Although I point out, if I'm correct, Michel has not engaged in any lobbying, but has certainly been one of the powerful intellectual forces shaping the Biden national security approach and strategy that's supposed to hit the ground running and actually try to get things done in quick fashion starting on January
Bogart, the 20th. She's on the board of Booz Allen.
She is on the board of Booz Allen, which for some has become something that you know is problematic. But I mean, as I said in the first segment, as you guys know, I mean, was there an expectation she was going to go and work at Tom McCann's shoes while she wasn't in government? Go ahead, Gordon, bring us over to the finish line.
Well, you may not want to even put this in, but I think you fail to appreciate adequately the importance of ethics rules in governments. That there is a very important piece of this that the Trump administration has violated in the extreme in terms of using the federal government for the benefit of its cronies and the businesses it's associated with. That extreme is one of the things that's generating this reaction. It's not an unanticipated reaction, and it's not an unusual reaction. It's a characteristic reaction. There needs to be, and this is me talking, a balance in the relationship that departments have with industries that benefit from what the department does, and the disclosure of those connections and the proper reporting of those connections and the honoring of those connections. It's all part of the ethical rules. I'm not speaking here as a representative of the Progressive Caucus. I'm saying this is not just a Progressive Caucus issue with a bunch of crazies out there. That's not what's going on here. It's a bigger, normal discussion.
That is true. But in the past, administrations themselves would closely monitor this, and members of Congress and certainly members of the Senate would monitor this. And in this particular case, we didn't have the White House monitoring rules that existed, and we certainly had nobody on the Senate who seemed to be, you know, in part because there are many members of the GOP who were not as uncomfortable with that as maybe they should have been. I suspect they will be very comfortable in voicing their opposition to anybody in the Biden administration. Much more to discuss here. Thank you very much all. Really appreciate it. It was a different kind of conversation today, in part because we had so many different issues, but really appreciate it. Hope everybody has a great weekend and look forward to having you guys back on next week. I should also point out that newspapers are reporting that about 130 Secret Service members of the Secret Service have apparently been infected by coronavirus. So there you go. It's getting worse, including in the president's orbit. And we certainly hope that everybody in that orbit, and including everybody affected, ends up recovering fully. Thanks very much again, everybody.
Thanks, Vago.
Thank you.
Thanks, Vago.
Thank you, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.